on ISCOT. I'll read this, gives you a general introduction to the subject. Early in ISCOT history, two disciples broke away from the movement and remarked, "This is not the society for Krishna consciousness, this is a society for Prabhupada consciousness." But another disciple replied, "What's wrong with Prabhupada consciousness? The Guru is a representative of Krishna." Prabhupada created the name ISKCON as well as the phrase Krishna consciousness, which he coined from a translation of a verse by Rupa Goswami. He shaped the society in his own personal way. He sometimes said that he never demanded that his disciples wear dhotis, and yet they did. They did because they wanted to follow Srila Prabhupada. A member of the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya and a disciple of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Prabhupada wrote his purports after great acharyas like Jiva Goswami and Baladeva Vidyabhusana, and yet he was an individual person. Thus, his society, ISKCON, bears the personal stamp of Srila Prabhupada. His particular viewpoint, for example, on why his god brothers did not vigorously follow the order of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur and why they did not assist Prabhupada when he began to actually spread the worldwide movement, this viewpoint of the history is adopted by Prabhupada's followers. He intended his personal stamp to last long into the future. He worked hard so that things would go on as he had set them up, even after his disappearance. He built temples to last for generations, and he set up a school system, intending that it would last as he introduced it. And he said that his books would provide the foundation of civilization for 10,000 years. These statements by Prabhupada do not exclude the possibility that other teachers may come and make great contributions, but neither should we overlook the fact that Srila Prabhupada is the only founder acharya of ISKCON. A special flavor is found in the Bhaktivedanta purports, and its essence is savored while its teachings are followed by Prabhupada's parampara descendants. Specific personal experiences of Prabhupada are found in his purports, as he drew examples for his teachings, and these are also part of the accumulated knowledge, which may be called smriti. "Do as I am doing," said Srila Prabhupada. It's not that he wanted a cult of personal worship of himself, but because he set the standard for his GBC leaders and for others, so he wanted his followers to do as he was doing. His intention was that his followers should work together to keep what he gave. The guru is a very personal teacher, and one may differ from another. For example, Srila Prabhupada translated the Nectar of Devotion, and yet in his personal demonstration of Krishna consciousness, he excluded some of the injunctions of the Nectar of Devotion, saying they were not practical according to time and place. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada's emphasis on what should be done and what shouldn't is an expert selection by an expert acharya. Prabhupada's personal stress on priorities in preaching, such as book printing and distribution, appear not to be simply personal with Srila Prabhupada, and yet they're actually his way, and Prabhupada also wanted that. Srila Prabhupada lived in a very deliberate way as an example, desiring that his followers should do as he did. He also said that his followers should expand beyond what he himself had done. Anyway, stop there. So, this principle about our founder Acharya doing things his personal way, is shastrically based. It's mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion, where Rupa Goswami says that this is called a detail, that your guru may teach differently than another guru. Rupa Goswami didn't deal with such things. He dealt with the generalities that everyone should accept the Vaishnava guru. That quote is, "Rupa Goswami proposes to mention only basic principles, not details. The basic principle is that one has to accept a spiritual master. Exactly how one follows the instructions of a spiritual master is considered a detail." For For example, if one is following the instruction of his spiritual master and that instruction is different from the instruction of another spiritual master, this is called detailed information. So this is not an unimportant detail. In fact, like this lecture is all about this detail, that that Prabhupada had his own way of teaching things, and that we followed that. Even though these details may not be found in the scriptures themselves. There was a time when this movement had barely even begun, and yet Prabhupada was very ill, and he went back to India. So at one point, the devotees in San Francisco said to Prabhupada, "Well, what if you're so ill you don't come back? Maybe should you send one of your godbrothers to carry on the movement here?" So that was reported by the disciple Mukunda, that Prabhupada thought about that, and he was very silent. And he said that his spiritual master was no ordinary spiritual master, and he saved me, he said. And then they began to understand the Prabhupada's response, that more about what spiritual master meant. So they dropped the idea of replacing him. And then Prabhupada explicitly said later that they should not call any of his godbrothers to come and take care of his disciples. He said, "If this person speaks just one word different from what I am speaking, there will be great confusion among you." He said it was an insult. The idea was an insult to the spiritual master. So why should we study these details? To better appreciate Prabhupada. That's what this series of lectures is about, to appreciate Prabhupada. So when we can see what they are and think, oh, that's true. That's actually a Prabhupadaism. It just didn't come even in the Bhagavad Gita just like that. It was the way Prabhupada presented it. And we appreciate more that we're following a personalized path. And help it when we see these things for what they are, helps us to develop loyalty and to understand them, why we do them, not just blindly. But there's a loyalty is there. If we're loyal, that helps us in many ways. That was also a Prabhupada Nectar thing about loyalty. And I'll just read only a few excerpts from it. Not being loyal to Prabhupada means to create a very serious erosion in the most crucial place, dedication to the Guru. Prabhupada once said that if you lose faith in the Guru, it's like a crack at the very foundation of your Krishna consciousness. Exclusive affection and loyalty to Srila Prabhupada is expressed in different ways. It is expressed when a follower stays in the place where Prabhupada sent him to and the service that Prabhupada gave him. Out of personal loyalty to Srila Prabhupada, one refuses to break the regulative principles because a disciple promises he will always follow them. So this is a very a strong thing, and it's based on personal following. We will also understand how much of what we are practicing was given to us by Prabhupada according to time and place and persons, the different things that we do. I'll mention some of these things now, but just before we go into some of these special things that we do that bears the stamp of Prabhupada, we'll give evidence of this happening in the past. this was taught in this in Srimad Bhagavatam in the case of Dhruva Maharaj, when Narada Muni ordered him to go into the forest, and based on the particular situation Dhruva was in, he said, because he was in the forest, he said, you can worship a deity, but just do it according to what's available there, what's convenient for you. And apparently he made a deity out of earth. So Prabhupada comments on this principle that things are done in a certain way in this ISKCON movement. And this is an important statement. He says, it is mentioned by Narada that one should take consideration of time, place, and available conveniences. Our Krishna consciousness movement is going on throughout the entire world, and we also install deities in different centers. Sometimes our Indian friends, puffed up with concocted notions, criticize, this has not been done, that has not been done. But they forget this instruction of Narada Muni to one of the greatest Vaishnavas, Dhruva Maharaj. One has to consider the particular time, country, and conveniences. What is convenient in India may not be convenient in Western countries. Those who are not actually in the line of acharyas, or who personally have no knowledge of how to act in the role of acharya, unnecessarily criticize the activities of the ISKCON movement in countries outside of India. Fact is that such critics cannot do anything personally to spread Krishna consciousness. If someone does go and preach, taking all risks, he may make some changes. But that's not faulty according to Shastra. The acharya can make those adjustments. This morning it came up in the class, we were talking about different grihastha rituals and which ones we can perform, and which ones are good and which one was. I made the point that, well, a good guide is which ones Prabhupada said. Prabhupada said Shraddha for ancestors doesn't have to be done, but that a version of Garbhadan Sanskara should be done before conceiving to have children. But even that, what it should be, he particularly said, which you may not perhaps find in any Shastra, just like that. So, although you may not find the things in the Shastra, the principles in the Shastra, which we just read, according to the time and conveniences, the Acharya set something up. And people who don't understand, they come later and they say, oh, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? Okay, so now here are some examples. And some of them we really take for granted that they just came down, but actually they were given by our founder Acharya. A little bit of their history and explanation. First is the quota that we have of 16 rounds to chant. A Prabhupada's spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, said to chant 64 rounds, or you're fallen. And some people say he sometimes told people they could chant only 4 rounds. But Prabhupada saw the condition of the people that he was preaching to, and so he said that we should chant 16 rounds. There's a nice memoir of one disciple's memoir of that. Mukunda again. Swamiji said, you must chant 64 rounds per day on your beads. I was shocked at this and could not answer. I did not know if there were any need to answer. I just kept looking at Swamiji and he looked at me. After some time he said, or at least you can chant 30 rounds a day. Still silence. I considered it to be very difficult to chant even 16 rounds. I was wondering how I could possibly chant 32 rounds. After some time, Swamiji said, at the very least, you must chant 16 rounds every day. I said, yes, Swamiji. I knew that I could at least try to handle that much. So because this is a detail, like we've already pointed out, detail is important. It's not unimportant detail. So we have to stick to this. Can anyone ask you, think of other examples of Prabhupada's reasoning about this particular thing, 16 rounds, why he basically reduced it. as much as he did, or you, or why he kept it as high as that, and didn't go lower. Anyone give any examples or heard anything why he introduced this?
The number, or just a quantitative amount?
Basically, the reduction is what I can think of. The reduction from previous.
Oh, well, because the Westerners are always busy.
Yeah.
To engage them in preaching work.
Very restless.
Yeah.
And then couldn't sit down and chant. And then also, then he gave us so much to do, also because to spread Krishna consciousness, that even he didn't want somebody to just do that if they said or said they could. He wanted them to be doing a lot of other things. But it was that Western proclivity for action that he saw, basically why he reduced it. But he didn't make us feel like defeated or inferior. But but proud in a sense that we had so much to do to spread Krishna consciousness. Although we knew that the 16 rounds was most important, it was only one part of our day's activities, and we had many other things to do for it, the spiritual master. All right. I've just picked a few examples out of many. Another one I thought of was Rath Yatra. It's not an automatic thing that devotees in worldwide Gaudiya Vaishnavism should perform Rath Yatra. You could say the general thing is festivals. There are many festivals. But the detail was this one, of course, Lord Chaitanya observed it. But Prabhupada picked it out that Rath Yatra should be done everywhere, in places where there's no previous tradition at all of Jagannath worship or Krishna worship. So it comes from his personal history. He grew up in the neighborhood in Calcutta where there was a good-sized Rath Yatra being done yearly. As a child, he saw it. It was near Jagannath Puri, but he didn't go there right away. But when he was very young, he saw the Rath Yatra, and then he started to do his own Rath Yatra as a child. And then we know the history in America. How it's not that he came here with a full, definite, open plan, but in San Francisco, one day devotees, they brought some little Jagannath deities, and then he asked them to carve bigger ones. One reason was that deity was chosen because he's very lenient and merciful. Prabhupada said the devotees were not up to a very high standard. And then, as he tells it, one day he was looking out his window and he saw a flatbed truck and he thought, why not put the deities on the truck and have a festival? And then it began and became a bigger and bigger thing. Any other reasons why he introduced Rath Yatra? And the festival is a nice way to introduce people. It's colorful, singing, dancing, parade, as they're now doing so wonderfully, Madhuha and everybody, the Festival of India, as they call it. It's really very pleasing, Prabhupada. Yes, a nice way to introduce people to Krishna. Yes, yes.
It's so directly related to Lord Chaitanya's pastimes.
Yeah. And of course, it has a very inner esoteric meaning, but generally people don't know that. But at least it has the meaning of Radharani bringing Krishna back to Vrindavan. But just that Lord Chaitanya would observe this festival, and that, and our movement is Lord Chaitanya's movement. Your point is, it's natural that he would pick that out, and not some festival about some other deity that a function that's not so intimately connected. It's not strange that he picked it. The worshipable deity of Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya went to the festival with great ecstasy. All right, then I got another one. This is a very prime one. Emphasis on preaching, and particularly by printing and distributing books. Now, this came in the Vaishnava Sampradaya, wasn't invented by Prabhupada, to preach. But he also particularly got it from his spiritual master, the emphasis on books. If you, he was disgusted about how his recent temple had become the focus of party spirit fighting over who would occupy the rooms. So he said, if you ever get money, print books. So it's a very personal thing and that he got from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And I would like to pause a little before going on about the book distribution to emphasize that a lot of the details which are Prabhupada's came from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. There's that one, which we can take up a little more again, book distribution. Another one is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's protesting against the caste conscious Brahmins. And as you know, the history is that there's a lot of things a revolutionary break was made in the Vaishnav habit or practice by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And so those details, a lot of them are just perfectly adaptable to spreading Krishna consciousness worldwide and have a dynamic purpose. And they were all taken up by Prabhupada as disciple. Another one was the rejection of the practice called Siddhadeha, where the disciple is told about his rasa with Krishna. And that was widely practiced by the Vaishnavas. Still is. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati rejected it. Prabhupada writes about this in Nectar of Devotion. In this connection, we should be careful about the so-called Siddha Pranali. The Siddha Pranali process is followed by a class of men who are not very authorized and who have manufactured their own way of devotional service. They imagine that they have become associates of the Lord simply by thinking of themselves like that. This external behavior is not at all according to the regulative principles. This so-called Siddha Pranali process is followed by the Prakriti Sahajiya, the pseudo-sect of so-called Vaishnavas. In the opinion of Rupa Goswami, such activities are simply disturbances to the standard way of devotional service. As long as one has any material desires, he can't practice his eternal rasa with Krishna. For example, to have a conjugal rasa with Krishna as a gopi, how could you at the same time have material sex desire? So that becomes very disgusting. A mixture of material and spiritual. So this was rejected by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and it certainly has no one takes it up in, as Prabhupada's following. Then, even among the followers of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, the followers of Prabhupada have a special stamp. And one of those things is the getting back to the book distribution. Although he taught that to all his disciples, Prabhupada really took it up, preaching in general, and preaching in that way. So we can ask, like we did about Rath Yatra and the rounds, why did he emphasize preaching? Because it's not hard to know why, that he was in the compassionate mood of the Vaishnava to help other people. And you see this as very much a characteristic of Prabhupada in all his preaching. He preaches to people that they should preach. And so anyone who follows him does like this. in one of his lectures that he gave in the storefront in 26 Second Avenue when things were just starting, I have the quotes from that, and I set the setting in the Prabhupada Lilamrita. Prabhupada is asking his hearers, who are only beginners in spiritual life, to become totally dedicated preachers of Krishna consciousness. He says, in the Bhagavad Gita, you will find that anyone who preaches the gospel of Bhagavad Gita to the people of the world is the most dear person to Krishna. Therefore, it is our duty to preach the principles of this Bhagavad Gita to make people Krishna conscious. Prabhupada can't wait to tell them, even if they aren't ready. It is too urgent. The world needs Krishna conscious preachers. So, he was doing that simultaneously, telling people the elementary Krishna consciousness and asking them to spread it. In so many letters, he advocates preaching. I'll just give a sample of one. If you feel at all indebted to me, then you should preach vigorously like me. That is the proper way to repay me. Of course, no one can repay the debt to the spiritual master, but the spiritual master is very much pleased by such an attitude by the disciples. So, and the best way to preach was to distribute books. He said, the books are perfect, better than your lecturing. And so because of that stamp, so many books, enormous amount of books, have been distributed all over the world and continue to be distributed in different languages. And this is a very important way that we serve Prabhupada and that the spreading of Krishna consciousness is accomplished. One letter again out of many. Here at Mayapur, my Guru Maharaj was printing one paper. It was selling for only a few paise. Sometimes whenever one brahmachari would go to Navadvip and sell even a few copies, I would see my Guru Maharaj become very much pleased. So I am always emphasizing book distribution. It is the better kirtan. It is better than chanting. Of course, chanting should not stop. But book distribution is the best kirtan. I'll mention some more now. Stamps of Prabhupada that show that out of the Gaudiya Vaishnava teachings, the way he taught it is a particular shape that we're following. There's the phenomena of the ISKCON temple. And what it's supposed to be, which you could say is partly based on Gaudiya Math, or a tradition of monasteries in India, but it's something special also that evolved with Prabhupada in the West. He wrote in one purport, in every center of our institution, ISKCON, we have arranged for a love feast every Sunday, and we actually see people come to our center, chant, dance, and take prasad, become jubilant and purchase books, then we know that certainly Lord Chaitanya is always present in such transcendental activities and he's very pleased and satisfied. Another particular thing with Prabhupada is aggressive confrontation with scientists, and that he particularly formed this Bhaktivedanta Institute. I think we'll be talking about them a little later, another lecture. Mixing of men and women. There are very strict injunctions in Vedas and Hindu society about mixing men and women. But Prabhupada adapted things. He says, a grihastha, vanaprastha, and brahmachari should be very careful when associating with women. One is forbidden to sit down in a solitary place, even with one's mother, sister, or daughter. In our Krishna consciousness movement, it has been very difficult to disassociate ourselves from women in our society, especially in Western countries. We are therefore sometimes criticized But nonetheless, we are trying to give everyone a chance to chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra and advance spiritually. And in the letter he says, because in your country there is no distinction between boys and girls or man and woman, they can freely mix without any restriction. So I did not give too much stricture on this point, because by such stricture they might be annoyed, and whatever Krishna consciousness they're trying to develop might have been checked. So sometimes to do these things was required bold action, intelligent decision-making, and criticism came. Prabhupada was criticized for giving the Westerners Brahman initiation and sannyas, and for mixing men and women to even the degree that he did mix them. Prabhupada accepted worship on a large Vyasasan, and still in ISKCON we carry this out for his divine grace. One time, of course, there was a first big Vyasasan that was in Los Angeles, and he accepted it and said some things about it. But then, even as late as 1977, he attended the Guru Pooj one day for himself when he was ill in Bombay, and then he spoke to the devotees about the importance of it. And it said at the end, so this Guru Pooj is essential, just as deity worship is essential. It is not cheap adoration. It is a process of enlightenment, of Divya Gyan. Not only was Prabhupada reminding his disciples that he hadn't forgotten them, but he was reminding them that they should not be absent from the Guru Pooj and worshipful thoughts of the spiritual master, even if he was not able to personally come before them. But that's something that's not so usually done in a Vaishnava temple every day, Guru Pooj and the big Vyasasan. Maybe now you can give me some examples of some things. Yeah.
Cow protection in the West.
What made you think of that? Yeah. There's a lot of philosophy about it. The cow should be protected. But in the West, there was nothing done. And that's something that apparently he would have given more details on if he had stayed longer right here at Gita Nagari. Maybe. You want to say more about that? Yes. Yeah. In the different forms, huh? Like at a Sunday feast, or to poor people. When we bring these things up, it's not that that this was never done by anybody before. But if you bring it up, maybe you can also give some evidence of that, or add that although you know it's a part of Vedic teachings, what your realization is that Prabhupada did, how he did it in a special way, or as you say, emphasized it more. In one sense, because he was so dynamic and his movement is dynamic, even though he took things that were traditional, they're really happening. They're supposed to happen, but no one else made them happen. And so anybody could be still staying in India and saying, yes, yes, we know all these things. But he was actually doing them all.
There were some things that he personally did that weren't really traditionally done, like traveling all, like a sannyasin was supposed to go.
Oh, yeah.
But he would travel around the world so many times. Also, marrying his disciples.
Yeah.
And also Brahmacharini Ashram. That's
what he said it was a concoction, but he concocted it.
Oh, Guru common issues for women.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real first, I think. That's interesting, his not only that he taught, but his personal habits, travel, etc. Others?
Finish up. What Rasala said reminded me of how the point was brought up when you and Hari Swari were speaking with Srila Prabhupada about Varnashram, and how it was being implemented as an intertwining with the Sankirtan movement, which is something the Gaudiya Math never did or anyone else previous. The intertwining of the Varnashram, which Lord Chaitanya rejected as inferior. But Prabhupada wanted to bring it out as a more merciful expansion of the movement.
Yeah, when we even brought up that Lord Chaitanya didn't teach that, he said, yes, but we are different. He was willing to innovate. All right, so I've got some questions now. We can move into... here's a few more that I have here. Presenting Vedic literature in many Western languages Krishna consciousness rectifies the Indians' failure to preach Lord Chaitanya's message, although they were told to. And then little things like, not little things, but restaurants, a particular thing. So many things like that. Okay, so my first question is, since Prabhupada applied the parampara according to time, place, and circumstances, why can't we, and change his details?
I would think that Srila Prabhupada is greatly more advanced than we are, and I can only speak for myself and probably ever hope to be, and that he was able to see, because of his spiritual purity, how to adjust properly according to time, place, and circumstance, whereas we might not be able to see how to do that.
It's a kind of a presumption, you're saying. I have some quotes here. It says, one should not deviate from or surpass the instructions of the spiritual master. No one should attempt to create or manufacture answers. As soon as a foolish disciple tries to overtake his spiritual master and becomes ambitious to occupy his post, he immediately falls down.
I was going to mention that Prabhupada already made the adjustment for Western culture. So he was coming from India, where Vedic culture is still somewhat intact, to a totally, planting into total foreign soil, and so he Prabhupada already made the adjustment for that transplantation to take place. And so for us to go ahead and make more adjustments is also kind of dangerous.
Yeah, it's not like he didn't adjust to our time and place. Okay, I have another group question, and then after a while you can give me some. I thought we could discuss blind following. First, in a positive sense, there is such a concept as blind following. Like Lord Chaitanya, he was told as a disciple by his spiritual master not to read Vedanta, that you're a fool, just chant Hare Krishna. So he didn't study Vedanta, but just followed the order of the spiritual master. But there is some negative application to what is a negative sense of blind following? Anyone say anything wrong with being a blind follower? Negativity.
I believe that's called to follow the rules and regulations without knowing the purpose behind them, and it's described as being characteristic of neophytes in all religions. that's also the if I understand, the thing that makes quarrels happen between different religions or within a religion.
So what is your basic point? To follow without understanding? Yeah. In the purport to 434 in the Bhagavad Gita, where he says you should serve and inquire from the spiritual master, Prabhupada says, in this verse, both blind following and absurd inquiries are condemned. So you should inquire and find out from the spiritual master why you're doing this. If you don't know why you're doing it or what it means, you should find out. You don't just do things dogmatically. You keep inquiring, not in a challenging way, but to understand, my dear spiritual master, what is this? Why do we do this? What is the basis for this? You just said such and such, but I don't understand it. Could you explain it some more? That's the opposite of blind following. A blind following is told in that story of Sargal Singh is dead. You know, everyone was crying that Sargal Singh is dead, and they were mourning. And then some intelligent person said, why is everybody crying about Sargal Singh? Who is he? And nobody knew. And he had to trace the story down, and Sargal Singh was just somebody's donkey. So everyone was a blind follower. They heard, oh, have you heard Sargal Singh is dead? So this is blind followers. They don't know why they're doing what they're doing. So we're talking about the stamp of Prabhupada and particular things he does. We should understand why we do them. Some of the things, they're quite personal, and they're just like endearing things, like when you ask what is the meaning of it. It's just that our beloved spiritual master, who did so many profound things and so many substantial things, at the same time, he does little things that are endearing to us, and we like to talk about them, and in some cases even follow them. And it doesn't have to be that they always have to have some deep philosophical reason. So there's some things like that in his use of language. One of his editor, Jayadwaita Swami, was saying things like, Prabhupada would pronounce words in a way as to give them a special meaning. For example, he would say ignorance as ignorance, and it would seem to give special meaning to the word because our ignorance was due to ignoring Krishna. Other times, Prabhupada would just pronounce words in ways that was logical, but not according to the correct usage. The most famous example is probably infinitesimal. Prabhupada would say infinite, and infinitesimal. And devotees, what was it? Infinite. The word is infinitesimal, but Prabhupada would say, like that, infinitesimal. Infinitesimal. And devotees always took special pleasure in these peculiarities of Prabhupada's speech, even to the point of adopting them in their own lectures. And of course, devotees have universally adopted Prabhupada's pronunciation of devotees rather than devotees. Of course, Jayadwaita Swami he's tried to expunge some of these grammatical errors in his course, that I think is good. But I heard in his course, when he got to devotees, he didn't even try. He said, of course, this is completely part of our language. I won't even try to... although he hinted you could say the way it's supposed to be said in proper English. But some of these things are just done out of affection. Either we don't have to follow them, but we can at least we find them endearing when we hear them. And some of them are not just grammatical errors, but different puns and things that Prabhupada said. There's no democracy. I call it demon crazy. Things like that. There are also sometimes some parts of the philosophy, the strict philosophical doctrines that he taught. You study in his books, and there's a certain way they're taught. One example is Prabhupada teaches about how the guru suffers by accepting a disciple's karma. And different Vaishnavas, either god brother or another Vaishnava, a friend of Prabhupada's, reputable devotees, they have a different view of what was actually taught about. They de-emphasize that the guru actually suffers. But if you look at Prabhupada's books, he repeatedly says it clearly. So these are like details of how he teaches, and there are others like that. All right, now I get some benefit from you if you'll help add to this course by writing some group questions of the kind that we've been doing. I mentioned last night, think of what you'd like to hear more discussion about. Put it in the form of a question. Or a challenging attitude you can take towards Prabhupada's particular stamp. Or just think of yourself as a teacher of this course, and what would be a nice question you'd like to throw out to the class. Chanting, such as in the Harinam Chintamani. Why then did Prabhupada place such strong emphasis on quantitative chanting as well? Well, you add the phrase here, as well. Doesn't mean that he didn't talk about quality. For him was always the don't commit 10 offenses. So he talked a lot about the 10 offenses. It was supposed to be in every initiation lecture. But in my mind, Prabhupada had a very simple presentation with great faith on what would happen if you chanted. And so there may not be so much analytical instruction about how to improve the quality. Like if devotees would ask, how can we control our minds? He would just usually say something very direct, short, like, well, chanting controls the mind. We might want to talk more about that, but he would just direct us to the process. Well, here, just here, you know, here's the chanting. What should I think about? Just here. So if we take these instructions on faith, that was my impression on what you might imply here as a lack of talking a lot about quality. That he did talk about it, but mostly thought just the act of doing it would bring about the desired result. Did you have some answers in mind that you brought it up?
Well, one thing I was thinking of is that the quantity brings about, potentially can bring about the quality.
Yeah.
Like you chant 4 or 6 rounds or whatever, it may be done very haphazardly, but 16 requires a great deal of energy.
Yeah. We were talking in the lecture about it being a reduction, but if you regard it as a lot, well, although Prabhupada seemed to have arrived at it almost with some humorous situations, that he arrived, well, 25, 32, all right, to 16, But actually, it became, it's now a very serious thing. And you can't reduce that 16, really, is, you know, so many letters talking about the 16 rounds. So that quantity, yeah, like you say, that he had faith in the practice of it, and also in that quantity must be done that much. And he regarded it as not much. What is 16 rounds? You can't do 16 rounds at 24 hours. Here's a controversial question. In light of what Prabhupada said concerning the talk of one of his godbrothers being a spiritual master for Prabhupada's disciples, how do we view such moves towards Prabhupada's godbrothers as given or done by his disciples? I say controversial because there are a number of disciples of Prabhupada who have done that, who accepted Shiksha Guruship from his Prabhupada's godbrother, particularly Sridhar Maharaj. And so there they are, and they're still godbrothers, and they're still devotees, and they're in his position. So if we just, if on the one hand we just condemn them, then we're gonna, for having done that, even if we consider it a mistake, and there's no hope for our having more sangha with them, relationship with them in the future. Maybe that there'll be come a time when there'll be more, forgetting even of the issues. But the other side of it is that he said, that he couldn't be replaced, it shouldn't be replaced, so that it seems to be a deviation from that. This is hotly discussed back and forth. You know, that those who did it claiming that they're why they did it and how they're still faithful to Prabhupada. I don't like to get involved in it in myself. I like to treat the cases individually, see if a person really is minimizing Prabhupada. We don't like to hear anybody minimizing Prabhupada. But if somebody is trying to sincerely explain why he did that and how he really has all respect for Prabhupada, try to hear what is his position. But I read the question out anyway, because it's a fair question. It's related to these topics of Prabhupada's stamp. Because if we didn't have Prabhupada's stamp on this movement, it wouldn't be what it is. It wouldn't be Prabhupada's movement. So it must be protected. About women. Prabhupada gave Brahmanization to women, but I heard one of his leading men say Prabhupada did so because the women were envious. So his conclusion was that women having Brahmanization shouldn't be taken seriously. Is this so, or is it a minimization of Srila Prabhupada's adjusting for Westerners? Yes, I think it is. We shouldn't judge it. Prabhupada did something and that we shouldn't take seriously based on reading into his act or having some scanty, you know, historical information. But you have to face what he actually did, if he actually did it and accepted. Can't say, oh, that Prabhupada didn't really mean that. if he said it enough times and upheld it. So he not only gave Brahman initiation one time in Boston based on a certain situation where the first Brahman was given to men and it wasn't given to the women, and then some of the women protested. So that's how it happened, but at that time Prabhupada says in a grain of rice you can see a whole rice. So he thought, well, what's this? I've given it to the men, the women saying they have to get it. Well, he thought about it. We would take it that he thought about it deeply, not frivolously. He knew that if he gave it to them, he'd have to give it to all of the women. Maybe some of you can, I'll just read one off and ask one of you to answer it. Would it be considered sentimental discussing more of his personal habits or characteristics, such as his walk, the way he drank water from a lota, his pinky extended, etc.? Are these characteristics helpful to our spiritual life to meditate on, or are they just for the sentimentals? Somebody answer. Maru?
They would be sentimental if we weren't considering Prabhupada and philosophy that he's given to us. But given that we've got that philosophy, and that's that we're practicing Krishna consciousness on that basis, then that would be a natural thing to want to know more about Prabhupada as a person. It would be like a loving thing to know more about him.
Yeah.
To know, in reference to God, Prabhupada, to know him is to love him, like that. So now we should cultivate knowledge. So similarly with Prabhupada, that we want to love him, so we want to know more about him. But there would have to be a philosophical basis there. First of all, that wasn't there. It was a good sentiment.
Right.
And understanding his position as a spiritual master.
I also had a similar question. I said, when does personality cult of Prabhupada become undesirable? And I made the point that if a person cultivates some of these Prabhupadisms or talks about them, but doesn't really follow, basically, then it can be a sentimental thing or an abusive thing. That would be... But it goes with being a follower, that you're, then you could, so to speak, entitled to enjoy all these endearing things about Prabhupada, and as you say, with appreciation of his greatness. So there's nothing wrong with relishing those things. Prabhupada emphasized book distribution so much to anyone, no discrimination, yet at the same time it is necessary to discuss them in the association of devotees in order to derive a proper understanding. Why then is massive book distribution such a key aspect of his mission? I can't understand that middle part. But he discussed it with anyone, yet at the same time it is necessary to discuss them in association of devotees.
Or someone reading them on their own.
Books?
Wouldn't understand them. If we have to get together as...
Then if it's necessary to discuss the books among devotees, then why do they emphasize so much mass distribution? I think one answer would be that he considered his purports to be a kind of association with devotees or meeting with devotees. The books are self-sufficient. And because he had a worldwide movement, which we hope would grow more and more, the people would read the books wherever they are in Alaska or Timbuktu, and then look up the devotees in nearby centers. So book distribution is not just by itself. You follow?
When I read the books, it seems like
when it's the deepest philosophy, and yet anyone can understand it.
Yeah.
So I guess it could again be a thing of quality. You can just go deeper and deeper into understanding it.
We have a class on just on Prabhupada's books and purports, which I don't understand. Well, I think we've run out of time. I'll use these questions for future classes. Tomorrow night's class is about some of Prabhupada's controversial teachings. How to appreciate them. All right. Thank you very much.